24-2947, Johnny Savory versus Alan Andrews et al. And we'll begin with oral argument, Mr. Sotos, from you.
Thank you, Your Honor. Counsel, may it please the court, good morning. This up a little bit. My name is Tom Sotos. I represent the defendants' appellants in this matter. I would like to reserve 5 minutes for rebuttal. Thank you. Today, we are asking the court to reverse the lower court's denial of summary judgment on four of plaintiffs' claims, specifically the denial of absolute immunity on plaintiff's fabricated confession claim stemming from his 1977 criminal trial, and the denials of qualified immunity on plaintiff's claims for destruction of evidence, coerced confession, and unlawful detention.
Why don't you begin with appellate jurisdiction?
Yeah, absolutely. So luckily, that's what I've got written down here, Judge. The bulk of plaintiff's brief, as you know, is not about the merits. It's about jurisdiction. I think the majority of this argument can be cut through with some expediency if you just look at the actual defenses to the claims themselves. It's our position that specifically three of the immunity defenses on appeal quite clearly arise out of exclusively undisputed facts. And those are very easy claims to resolve jurisdictionally. Those are the immunity defenses to the destruction and fabrication claims, which have extremely narrow factual predicates. Those are undisputed factual predicates. And then there's the coerced confession claim. That claim requires us to accept all of plaintiff's allegations about his interrogation tactics. He was present for his interrogation. So all of the facts that we have brought up on appeal, we are accepting his version of events. Our immunity defense simply asks whether those tactics violated clearly established law in 1977. As we see it, the only superficial factual issue, and I emphasize superficial, comes from our qualified immunity defense to the unlawful detention claim, and specifically to our contention that six witness statements contribute to arguable probable cause. Plaintiff claims, and the lower court did find, that because plaintiff alleges that the six witnesses' statements to officers must have been fabricated, he is entitled to that inference, even though his evidence, his only evidence for that allegation, is his denial that he made inculpatory statements to the witnesses in the first instance. But that lower court finding, that does not arise out of a dispute of fact. We accept, and we have always accepted for summary judgment purposes, that plaintiff has denied making inculpatory statements to the witnesses. And we accept that plaintiff, that the in plaintiff's version of events, the officers, based on that denial, he's entitled to the inference that the officers fabricated those witness statements. But the granting plaintiff that inference at the summary judgment stage, that defies probable cause law. It's a very narrow legal issue. It does not actually arise out of a dispute in evidence. The key case here is Coleman versus City of Peoria. That's a 2019 case. This is talked about in our brief. There, this court doubled down on a long line of cases holding that absent evidence showing that officers at the time of their investigation have reason to doubt the reliability of third-party witness statements. Officers are entitled to rely on those witnesses' statements for probable cause in the face of a suspect's denials.
But isn't the argument here, though, a little bit different? At least the way I saw it, Coleman is not an interlocutory appeal, Coleman. But isn't the question here, the way at least I see the plaintiff's argument, is that he's alleging that the police officers knew at the time they were determining probable cause that the witnesses' statements were fabricated, which distinguishes this case from Coleman, I think, or the argument that you just made.
I appreciate and agree with the distinction about the procedural posture in the case. In addition, what you said about the allegation is true. Plaintiff is alleging that, but summary judgment law, federal rules of evidence, and law governing probable cause are exceedingly clear on this. An allegation alone is insufficient to defeat summary judgment, regardless of the circumstances.
Even when the district court, though, found that there was a dispute of fact?
We believe that there are two ways for the court to address this. We believe because the court's finding on that issue arises out of a clear error of probable cause law, that is an abstract issue of law this court can adjudicate solely based on the law itself. The granting of plaintiff the inference on the unlawful detention claim about the six witness statements comes from a misunderstanding of the way that officers are entitled to rely on information they receive at the time for probable cause purposes. The only evidence in this case of any, I hesitate to call it doubt, but granting plaintiff those kinds of inferences, unreliability of a witness statement, doubt of a witness statement, the only actual evidence of that comes from 1981, 4 years after the investigations. The only basis to find any sort of disputed fact or an inference, or to withhold these statements from the police officer's purview in the probable probable cause context, is to simply permit plaintiff to say that the officers fabricated the statement. That is speculation. And the district court held this in the context of the 1981 fabricated evidence claim.
But my question, though, is once the district court says that there's a dispute of material fact on that issue, what's our jurisdiction to review that?
Our first answer would be that you can step in because it's an abstract issue of law on the probable cause. The error comes from the law. It comes from probable cause law. However, accepting the premise that this is a dispute of fact.
Why can't we fix that? Okay, so you're saying there's an error the way the district court determined the way probable cause is analyzed. Why can't we fix that? What does that have to do with the district court's determination that there was a dispute of material fact on that issue?
Well, in Mannery versus Lee, in a number of cases, the court has held if we accept plaintiff's version of the facts, even allowing for a lower court finding of disputed fact, this court can address the abstract issues. And my representation here is that we are accepting that Savory is saying what he's saying. What our argument is one step past.
But don't you have to accept, though, if you're going to accept that, don't you have to accept that the witness's statements were fabricated and that the police officers knew it in 1977? Hold on one second.
Absolutely.
You accept the fact that the police officer's statements were fabricated. I'm sorry, the witness's statements were fabricated. The police knew it in 1977. But then you argue that there's still probable cause even throwing out the witness's statements.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I understand the proposition. In the interest of time, we do not believe that we have to accept that there is a disputed fact about whether the statements themselves were fabricated in 1977, because there was no evidence to back that up. And the finding of disputed fact arose out of a misapplication of probable.
What's your best case to support that argument for interlocutory jurisdiction?
That argument flows from the theory that this court has jurisdiction to address abstract issues of law at the interlocutory stage. We do not have a specific case addressing this. However, granting the proposition that there was a finding of disputed fact by the lower court, which theoretically should impede interlocutory jurisdiction, accepting that as the premise. And I understand the district court did find that here. In Johnson versus Jones, the case that kind of sets the groundwork for all of these interlocutory appeals, the Supreme Court specifically anticipated instances where district court findings of fact would be insufficient and the Seventh Circuit and any other circuit would have to take on a greater burden. It did not say it would happen frequently, but it said it would have to happen. Now, the Supreme Court said in Johnson versus Jones that the instance they anticipated was where a district court failed to give the court findings of fact that they could use for the interlocutor appeal. So the Court of Appeals would have to go down and make their own findings of fact. However, since Johnson versus Jones, a number of circuits have taken that holding. They've also looked at Scott versus Harris, and they have found that where a district court's findings of fact are inadequate, this language in particular comes from Taffy versus Wenger. This is a 11th Circuit, it's a federal appendix opinion, but it uses a surfeit of 11th Circuit case law to find this. Where a district court's findings of fact are inadequate, Johnson versus Jones permits the courts of appeals to go in and take their own look at the facts to make sure that there are genuine disputes. In Jeffers versus Gomez, this is a 9th Circuit case, the 9th Circuit specifically found that district court findings of fact that are based on findings of disputed fact that are based on allegations as opposed to genuine evidence are insufficient to deny jurisdiction for an interlocutory appeal. We would direct the court to those cases. We would suggest that if the court were to go the other way, there is a risk of inter-circuit split on that issue. I would remind the court again, we believe that the court can address this issue narrowly and clearly as a matter of arguable probable cause and probable cause law, because the error arose as a matter of law. The district court misapplied U.S. versus Williams. It failed to observe Coleman versus City of Peoria and its progeny. That's Graminos, that's Reynolds. And the error flows from that. However, if the court wants to wade into the facts, we believe the court has the jurisdiction to do that. Johnson versus Jones allows that. It specifically says the court can do that in specific instances. Beyond that, briefly to try to tie up the jurisdictional issue, the absolute immunity defense, the fabricated confession claim, there's one fact there, it's undisputed. The allegedly fabricated confession was only introduced at the 1977 trial by officer testimony. That is undisputed. It's the only fact giving rise to that defense. Jurisdiction is clear.
Was it introduced in the second trial?
It was. We did not raise the defense with the second trial because there are some lower court decisions that suggest where the police report is used, absolute immunity is not available. The police report in the second trial, 1981, it was used to refresh recollection. It was referenced. In the 1977 trial, it played no role. That's why we raised it there. For the For the destruction of evidence claim, again, very narrow factual predicate. We accept that the evidence was destroyed in 1977. That's the only evidence, that's the only time in the record where the evidence goes missing. We accept that the officers implicated did it. And the parties agree DNA testing did not exist for quite some time. Those are undisputed facts. On the coerced confession claim, again, we have to accept all.
Where in the record are you getting that the evidence was destroyed in 1977?
I appreciate the question, Judge Jackson. It has been somewhat difficult for defendants to adduce this. It is the only, we argued in the lower court that there is no evidence of destruction in and of itself. The lower court rejected that merits finding. We remain a little bit unclear why. The only evidence in the record of the evidence going missing and the last time it was in contact with any of the Peoria Police Department officers is 1977. There are two police reports from September of 1997. I can get the I can get the docket sites for you that mentioned Cannon and Jackowski in the context of destruction. And then at trial, I believe it was Jackowski, it might have been non-defendant Gunsowski, who mentioned that they couldn't, the cutout wasn't around anymore and they couldn't find the hair.
The 77.
That was in 1977. After 1977, there's no tethering of the officers to the evidence. There's any allegation of destruction post 1977 is purely an allegation. There's no evidence of that. I would like to reserve the remainder of my time, if I may.
Very good. Thank you, Mr. Sokos.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Ms. Pierce, we'll move to you. You should be able to lower. Derek can help you.
A little bit shorter than my opposing counsel.
In my last argument in this court before I became a judge, I hit the button, it went down. The person who had to argue after me was very upset with me.
I'll do it to him.
All right.
They had a disabled judge.
Oh, sorry. Okay.
All right.
Ms. Pierce.
Good morning, Your Honors.
Morning.
May it please the court. Defendants misrepresent the law in this jurisdiction and from the Supreme Court about when the court has jurisdiction over an interlocutory appeal. This circuit has been clear that this court may not consider the district court's determinations about sufficiency of the evidence. And this court has been clear that the defendants must take all evidence in Mr. Savory's favor on interlocutory appeal. They have to argue that they can that this is a legal question because their whole appeal is challenging the facts that the district court found on summary judgment.
Ms. Pierce, can I ask you a question regarding that, the appellate jurisdiction issue? If the district court, take the fabrication of the witnesses' statements, if the district court, the defendants offer the witnesses' statements and say in 1977, based on the witnesses' statements, there was the police had at least arguable probable cause. And the plaintiff's only response to that is, I deny that fact, and I submit that the statements were fabricated. And there's no evidence whatsoever to support the argument or the position that the statements were fabricated. If the district court was determining that at summary judgment, usually the district court would disregard that bald denial and accept the defendant's fact that they relied upon the plaintiff's statements. But if the district court accepted the plaintiff's denial and said, I'm going to accept that, okay, and I'm going to find a dispute of material fact on that issue, is there appellate jurisdiction to review that in the qualified immunity context?
No, Your Honor, there is no jurisdiction.
What case supports that proposition? What's your best case to say that there is no appellate jurisdiction, even if the district court erred in determining that there was a dispute of material fact?
Yes, Your Honor. I think there are a number of cases. There is Johnson v. Jones from the Supreme Court that says determinations about sufficiency of the evidence cannot be reviewed on interlocutory appeal. And then a multitude of cases from this circuit as well. There is.
But sufficiency of the evidence is a little bit different.
Yes, Your Honor. But in that case, the district court.
I mean, take a very simple example. There's, you know, plaintiff says the light was red. Okay. Defendant says the light was red. District court says, I find a dispute of material fact on that issue. There clearly isn't. Both sides agree, okay? But the district court says, I find the disputed material fact. One side appeals and says the district court clearly made an error in determining that there was a disputed material fact. Do we have jurisdiction to review that error?
So I think there is Scott v. Harris has identified a very narrow circumstance in which there is incontrovertible evidence in the record that directly contradicts the
and
plaintiff.
Video evidence.
Yes, and in that case, it is video evidence. That is a very narrow circumstance. And we do not have to decide exactly where that ends because that is absolutely not the case that we have here. And defendants have said that we are, that Mr. Savory's did not, has presented no evidence that he's relying on mere allegations that these statements were fabricated, but that is not true. There is ample evidence in the record, both that these statements were fabricated, and even if this court did credit them, that the defendants knew that they were completely and wholly unreliable. And if the court will indulge me, I'll get into a little bit of that evidence here. Ella Ivey is one of the individuals whose statements they rely on. She testified later during post-conviction proceedings where she directly denied that she ever made those statements to defendants. Again, Mr. Savory has said that he never made these statements to any of these witnesses. He also denied making statements that defendants attributed to him and put in their reports. Witnesses who they are not relying on here, Wendy Sankey, they wrote reports in which they said that she made different various statements that, again, she denied saying. At deposition. Tina Ivey later said that Mr. Savory never made these statements to her. If we look at
are you tying that to the police officer's knowledge of 1977? We see cases all the time where witnesses come in 5, 10, 2, 8 years later and say, I never made those statements. That's not true. I knew it was not true at the time. That happens all the time.
Ella Ivey said she never made these statements to the defendant
in
1977. In 1977. And then if you look at Ray Mason's statements, he is questioned on 5 separate times, 4 times, the first two and the second and the last two. He denies that he ever had any conversation with Johnny Lee Savory about these murders and that he knows anything about these murders. There is one single report from Defendant Cannon in which he says that Ray Mason told him on the morning of the murders, Johnny Lee Savory called him and told him that his friends were dead. He denies repeatedly making this, and then other officers called his uncle and confirmed that he was actually with his uncle the entire day from early in the morning until late in the evening and could not have received a call from Johnny Lee Savory. And then when these officers went and wrote that they verified with him that this call, in fact, never made sense, they wrote in their report that they verified the call never happened. Ray Mason told them that he was confused by Cannon's accusations and his tone. There is ample evidence in the record, both that these statements were never made and that the defendants knew that they were completely and wholly unreliable, because after this, they never used these statements. They never called these witnesses to testify, and they never brought them to trial because they knew these were not real statements. There was no probable cause here.
What's the length of the, what's the period of illegal detention that you're claiming damages for here?
From the time of his indictment until he is convicted at his first trial, I believe, is the time period.
Okay, so it's just the few months. I don't remember exactly what the time period is, but the time that he was detained, I guess, in jail until the time of the trial in 1977.
Yes, sir.
All right. So can I move on to a different subject on the coerced confession?
Yes, sir.
What you cited a litany of cases in the red brief on coerced confessions, and what's your best case regarding the facts here that the police are, I mean, you're citing cases where an individual is deprived without sleep for 48 hours. I mean, I'm making this stuff up, but some of these cases are so wildly unanalogous to the situation here. What case should we look to as your best case for clearly established law in 1977 that the police officers knew what they were doing was unconstitutional?
Yes, Your Honor. I believe that the two strongest cases here that just if we want to look at a single case are Haley and Gallegos. But I also want to reiterate that what is required here is not one single case that is directly on point with all of the same circumstances and all of the same tactics used. This has never been required by qualified immunity.
Right. I understand.
Okay.
But it's hard to say. I mean, it's hard to say a situation where a defendant
was, you know, a criminal defendant was not fed for 48 hours is analogous to a situation where a subject who's interrogated is fed for lunch. And that's what I just see the red beaters trying to stretch from, you know, well, this person was deprived of sleep for 48 hours and Mr. Savely only got 6.5 hours of sleep. So we can extrapolate from the 48 hours plus the hamburger, plus the fact that he was 14, plus the fact that he only got to meet with his father for a short period of time. We can extrapolate from all these other cases and say that what happened here was clearly unconstitutional. That's what I think you're trying to do, but maybe I'm wrong.
I think Your Honor is looking at a little bit too detailed level of specificity. Again, this is not required here. What is required under Tolan is bare notice. The courts have said for a long time that we must look at totality of the circumstances. And of course, there is never going to be a case with exactly the same circumstances and the exactly the same tactics used. That does not mean that defendants are not on notice, that the tactics they are using are coercive. The Supreme Court has repeatedly provided guideposts that let defendants know let officers know when their conduct is getting out of bounds. And then here, Haley and Gallegos are particularly on point. And these courts go into detail describing exactly why a 14-year-old like Johnny Lee Savory is unable to match the power of the law when multiple officers are up there interrogating him over 30 days and teams. Asking him confusing, rapid fire, overlapping questions. And here in this case, Haley talks about an individual, a 14-year-old who was interrogated from 12 a.m. until 5 in the morning, just 5 hours, much less than Mr. Savory here. And he was deprived of any supportive adult figure, just like Mr. Savory here. And he was... And there are factors, and those are the factors there and Haley that the Supreme Court said this has made this this interrogation coercive and unconstitutional. And Haley put defendants on notice here. In our case, there are additional factors that make this not just more coercive than Haley and Gallegos, but obviously coercive and unconstitutional. The officers here, Mr. Savory told them that he no longer wished to speak to him. They made it clear that he could not end this interrogation. They brought him back and they continued to question him. Your Honor has spoken about whether it matters if an individual is given lunch one day or not provided food for 48 hours. The district court found here that Mr. Savory was provided, that Mr. Savory was denied adequate food. Over 2 days, he was given a candy bar and a hamburger. This weakened him and made it more likely that his will would be overcome, and defendants knew this. And they did multiple things to render Mr. Savory totally hopeless. They told him that he could go home if he took a polygraph exam. Then they subjected him to two separate polygraph exams that they knew had no valuable basis, and then falsely told him that the polygraph exam results implicated him in the murders. They took him to the bathroom where they stripped him down naked and forcibly pulled hairs from his body. They did not provide him with any adult advocate. His father came at one point and they were unable to communicate and yelled at him and left him more susceptible to the pressures of the officers here. And then left. He had no friendly adult with him at any point during the interrogation. And he was interrogated more or less continuously over 30 hours, except for 6 hours where he was left at a detention center to sleep on a thin mattress for less than 6 hours.
Can I shift to asking you about just one defendant? It's Bowers.
Yes.
Because the Supreme Court has told us we have to consider qualified immunity defenses based on each officer's conduct. And, you know, we have this case law that what Bowers did at the end of his interrogation, he was all in Mr. Savory's face and accusing him of being a murderer, et cetera, et cetera. And he did not at that time, there is some evidence, have knowledge of what the officers before him had done. Should that lead us to conclude that Bowers alone is specifically entitled to qualified immunity? What do you say about Bowers?
The district court found that Mr. Bowers was involved in a conspiracy to obtain a false confession from Mr. Savory. There is evidence in the record that supports that Mr. Bowers was aware. He was briefed by defendant Tuplitz about what had happened earlier in the interrogation. He was a former police officer who had worked closely with his officers, and he was present at the police station. A jury, this must go to a jury to decide exactly what role Mr. Bowers had in this interrogation, but a jury could conclude that he was aware of and was acting with together with the other defendants to interrogate Mr. Savory.
Does your answer flow because there is the presence of the conspiracy charge, or even if there wasn't the presence of the conspiracy charge, we should still find that Bowers is not entitled to qualified immunity?
I think even without the conspiracy, there is evidence that he was aware and was working as part of this team to interrogate him. But I think those go hand in hand with the conspiracy. I'm not quite sure if they're separable. So I believe here there are no distinguishing factors there are no meaningful distinguishing factors that between Mr. Savory's case and Haley and Gallegos. And then there were multiple additional factors that have been clearly identified as coercive. Yes, the court still has to consider the totality of the circumstances. And yes, the officers have to consider the totality of the circumstances. But under these totality of the circumstances, the officers were on fair notice that they were violating Mr. Savory's constitutional rights. I'll say briefly with regard to the destruction of evidence, that is premised completely on a dispute of fact here. Mr. Savory, the district court found that there was evidence that the defendants would have been aware of the exculpatory value of the evidence. One, that there was no blood on the pants, and two, that the hairs were, the defendants themselves, through their probable cause arguments, are arguing that the hairs are able to implicate the true perpetrator of the
mistake. Does that claim only arise, though, in 2013?
No, that claim arises when he could have used the, at any point that he could have used the evidence.
Did he ever ask to you? I mean, in other words, what I'm troubled by is, let's assume the evidence was destroyed in 1977. What difference does that make if nobody asked to make use of the evidence until 2013, I think?
I don't think it makes a difference because at that point he was deprived of his ability to test the evidence, which would have been.
But he never asked to test the evidence. I mean, that's suggesting, wow. I mean, that is such a broad statement because police get rid of evidence all the time. And clearly in 1977, there was no established case law that said they have to keep all evidence forever.
That's correct, Your Honor, but the law does say that they have to maintain potentially exculpatory evidence and that they cannot destroy it in bad faith. Here, defendants are not disputing that they acted in bad faith for good reason. There's ample evidence that they acted in bad faith in this case. And the potential exculpatory evidence, value of the evidence was more than apparent. Plaintiff has argued that defendants fabricated that there was blood on the pocket of the pants. This was not challenged at summary judgment. That claim will go to trial.
But not in 1977.
Yes, Your Honor. The plaintiff is
No. In 1977, the plaintiff asked for the pants and the police said, we can't find them. No, I don't think those are the facts, right? I think in 2013, I think around then, the plaintiff asked to have DNA testing on the blood because he said it would exonerate him. And the police said, we don't have it. And so if the purposes of our analysis, we have to assume that they didn't have it as of 1977, but there's no evidence of that.
The evidence was destroyed, and that has to be accepted. Mr. Savory could have used.
I understand that.
And Mr. Savory could have used the pants at any point, including in 2013.
Had he ever asked to use the pants before 2013?
Not that I'm aware of, and not in the record. But in 2013, he asked to test the pants, and he would have been able to show that there was, in fact, no blood on the pants.
I got it. But if we accept that argument, don't we have to accept that the police had to keep the evidence from 1977 until 2013, anticipating that DNA testing would be available at some future point and that perhaps he would be exonerated?
I don't think they would have had to anticipate that DNA testing would have been available because just the testing to show that there was no blood on the pants would have been exonerating of Johnny Lee Savory.
Okay, but is it your contention that the police knew in 1977 that they had to keep the pants for 50 years?
They did know that they had to preserve the pants, and they did know that they could not destroy them in bad faith. Well, Peoria's policy here, I believe, required them to
forget
preserve
the policy. I'm talking about the United States Constitution.
Sure. I think they have to preserve it in perpetuity, I believe.
In perpetuity. Okay. That's what I thought your argument was. And I don't think there was anything in 1977 that would require police officers to keep evidence in perpetuity. But I might be wrong.
And if I understand your argument is there was testing available in 1977 that could have just shown there was no blood on the pants. And that is what could have been available to Mr. Savory.
Yes, Your Honor. Yes,
and,
Your Honor.
And do you agree with the defendant's lawyers that they're asking us to make an inference that the evidence was destroyed in 1977?
I don't think it matters whether the evidence was destroyed in 1977 or at some point in between. I don't think it matters here.
Thank you, Ms. Pierce. Mr. Sotos, we'll move to you now for rebuttal argument.
Thank you, Your Honor.
I'm going to briefly try to supply the court with some items that it had asked for throughout the argument. Johnson versus Jones. This is what Johnson versus Jones says. This is a quote, that the collateral order doctrine, quote, occasionally requires a detailed evidence-based review of the record. I think that this case, if you look at Taffy versus Wenger, this is the kind of case where that that edict might apply. Again, we have tried to argue why arguable probable cause law settles the issue. But between Johnson versus Jones and Scott versus Harris and the way that the Sixth Circuit interpreted those in Rodriguez, this is in our brief, the way the 11th Circuit interpreted them in Taffy, we think that that sets a nice framework for analysis of an inadequate finding of fact in this case. The September 1977 ports, Judge Jackson Akwumi, those are dockets 320-39 and 320-40. The notion that the destroyed evidence could have been destroyed at any time and we don't need to timestamp that, that belies the test for destruction of evidence. And the destruction of evidence test from Youngblood, from Trombetta, specifically says that we need to know about exculpatory value, whether the officers knew of exculpatory value at the time of destruction. The only evidence in the record of when these items went missing comes from 1977. There's some discussion in the trial record about these items being missing in 1977. The test requires us, for qualified immunity purposes, we are just trying to see if the officers had a duty to preserve from that point on. There was quite a bit of discussion about the fabrication, the witness statements themselves. Ella Ivey maintained in this case, in her deposition testimony, that the statements we rely on that are in our brief that we have provided the court were truthful. I sympathize with opposing counsel, our lawyers, the court. This is an unwieldy record. This is a very difficult record. It is extensive. It is expansive. It is old, which creates its own issues. However, we lay this out in our brief. One of the concerns with simply deferring to factual presumptions made is that you lose the genuine viability of entitlement to immunity in a messy record.
That's why they allow interlocutory appeal.
This is the reason why the collateral doctrine allows me to be here. There are defendants in this case. There are some claims that are going to go to trial against some defendants. There are other defendants in this case. If qualified immunity is resolved in their favor, they are out of the case. If the coerced confession claim goes away, Sergeant Andrews is likely out of the case because he's only in on a failure to intervene claim in the coerced confession. If Sergeant Bowers is found qualifiedly immune, we have significant doubts about the viability of the conspiracy claim against him in the lower court. Mr. Jackowski, we emphasize the individuality of Bowers' actions in the brief. We think Sergeant Jackowski deserves a particularly strong look about the constitutionality of his tactics in the coerced confession case. All he did was essentially get evidence from Mr. Savory's person. He wasn't involved in any of the questioning of any of that sort. If that claim is resolved in his favor, he is very likely to be out of the case. Indeed, Ms. Teplitz may well be out of the case. We don't believe that she's part of the 1981 fabricated confession claim if these claims are resolved in her favor. So this is a long way of saying the qualified immunity doctrine and absolute immunity in some ways, the purpose of it is to resolve claims that are not viable for which officers did not have fair notice before trial, before they have to face a trial. And I appreciate that the Seventh Circuit has some case law saying that we defer to the district court's findings of fact. However, over deference, over indulgence of a messy record, it deprives entitled defendants to immunity that the Supreme Court has held for decades. They are due where there is not clearly established law. There will be a trial. Some of these defendants will have to face that jury. But some defendants can be out of the case now if the court will exercise jurisdiction and rule in their favor. So for the reasons articulated in our briefs, we would ask the court to reverse the four denials of immunity in this case. And for those defendants who shouldn't go to trial, let them be done. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Sotos. Thank you, Ms. Pierce. The case will be taken under advisement.